Rules Committee is called to order. The time is 8:29, and the date is April 16th, and we're meeting in the Butkovich Room. Members present are Representative O'Connell, Representative Phillips, and the Chair. Members absent are Representative Hayes, and Representative Smith is excused. I'm going to recess the committee until we have a couple witnesses. I'm going to call the Rules Committee back to order. I didn't mention the agenda, but I will now. We have House Bill 357, an act relating to adult public assistance, and Senate Bill 834, an act continuing the existence of the Guide Licensing and Control Board. We do have some people from the Health, Education, Social Services Agency to testify, and would you like to start out, and we
sure.
Pick a commissioner up later. If you'll identify yourself for the record, please.
I'm John Pugh, the Director of Division of Family and Youth Services, and Commissioner Disco.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, I'm a few minutes late here.
Would you identify yourself to Commissioner?
Yes. Helen
both
Byrne.
You and John can
very good.
Work together.
Helen Byrne, Commissioner of Health and Social Services, Health Social Services. We have some material to hand out to you, Mr. Chairman, that indicates, and you aren't going to have time to read it certainly right at this moment, but I think most of it you had the opportunity to see when it was discussed with finance. We do want to bring to your mind that it's a very important issue we're talking about in this repealer, and I can understand why a repealer in a large bill would be overlooked. But what we're really talking about is a difference of possibly $2 million in state expenditures in whether or not we do have a chance to repeal a bill, a statute, which over the years has become relatively ineffective in terms of the state being able to control the situation. And I'm going to leave a lot of this to John Pugh and let him explain just what we're talking about in terms of the statute itself, how we could change that, either repealing it or modifying it, so that the state would have the opportunity to control this. And so why don't we just have to...
Thank you, Commissioner. Go ahead, John.
Yes. In the process of the House Finance Subcommittee on Health and Social Services this year, the request was made by the chairman of that committee, Representative Carney, to ask the department that could we take a $2 million cut in the program called Juvenile Custody, BRU, in the Division of Family and Youth Services, institutional care component. And the department responded to Mr. Carney's request for information, indicating that the only way that we could take a cut in this program, which is basically a formula program, by the way the present statute is by having the statute either repealed or amended and reenacted so that it would allow the department to contract, actually negotiate for rates with these facilities. The present situation is that in this purchase of service statute, which is 4740, is that under this, the legislature, which enacted this in 1971, it's known as a full cost of care statute, and what happens in the formula is that each year there is an audit of the facilities, and how the amount of money that was expended in the past year is divided by the census that you have in order to come up with the next year's rate. So in a sense, what it does is it 1 year settles for, 1 year later settles for everything that was expended. The problem with the law is two things. One, that you are paid for your census on the basis of how many kids you have, and it does not take into effect how many empty beds you have. An example, I think, Representative Fuller mentioned a while ago, if somebody has, for example, 10 beds and only 5 beds were filled, it's divided by 5 rather than the 10 beds, and therefore you pay for the extra empty 5 beds even if it was staffed. There's some similarities in some of the hospital legislation and things over the years, nursing home care, that kind of thing. But this has been a lot more serious because it's a very hard situation to control. Whereas under contracting, we could actually contract for the number of placements that we need rather than for empty beds.
And as I understand this, Mr. Pugh, is that the amendments we made in rules the other day, other than the repealer, takes care of this, being able to contract out and so forth.
The repeal would. The repeal would, the commissioner, under the commissioner's authority, would have the power to contract and negotiate with the facilities. Now, there has been over the years, 3 years ago, the governor submitted legislation to amend the statute to allow us to contract, and the department certainly has not in the past opposed legislation to actually amend to contract. But at this point in time, the House Finance determined not to go with the contracting statute, and my understanding from Representative Adams was that they felt the repeal was, you know, as late as it was in the session, was the best thing to do, because we do have, commissioner does have broad powers to contract with, you know, to provide the services. So that was the reason that we ended up with this repeal rider on 357.
So that's the only thing you oppose this morning, is the repeal of 4740.
Well, we oppose the removal as it was taken out yesterday. The final, I think the other thing that needs to be known is that the other thing that does increase the rates here, and they have increased 82% since 1979, is that donations can be utilized by the facilities or other sources of money to expand programs, add staff, and we are required 1 year later to build that into our rates. There's no way for us to prevent facilities from using money. The way the statute indicates is whatever the expenses are, we divide it by the census, and we cannot limit those expenses. And that's one of the things that has continued to be a real problem with the statute. So we feel the statute has real problems, and it would be better to repeal it. If we had time to do a contracting statute, we would have no objections to that. But like I said, that Representative Adams felt it was not time to do that in this session.
And you're saying the action we took yesterday adds $2 million to your problem.
Essentially,
is that correct?
It does. In fact, we have Representative Attorney General here. We have an Attorney General's opinion that has indicated in the past that we cannot ratably reduce these facilities. We would have to cut placements, and our estimate at $1 million is we would have to cut between 28 and 50 placements. At $2 million, we're talking about somewhere between 40 and 80 beds that we would actually have to cut, because the present rates are $109, average rates are $109, and if we don't change this, the rates automatically at least go up for the amount that they have expended. And in the past years, this has ranged anywhere from 5% to 22%, what we call an allowable cost, which we have no control over. And so the second part of that is that we, which has not been tested, is the law, which could increase it even more in terms of the possibility of a supplemental, is that we have never tested the part of the statute that says we are also required to provide a proportionate share of a cost of living. And under this cut, $2 million, and even if it was $1 million, we cannot give any cost of living this year. It will be 0%. And there's a good chance that we will be taken to court on that, and a good chance the court will say a proportionate share means at least you're going to have to grant half of what the actual cost of living is, whatever else. So we feel that with all of those things sitting there, if we do want to reduce the budget this year, if that's the legislative intent, then we have to have the repeal in order to do that.
Are there questions of Mr. Pugh? Randy?
Here in this package, you have, I guess you and the health care providers got together in compromise language. Was this proposed in the House Finance Committee, or?
I would say that we did not get together. The providers provided that to us, and we met with them and indicated that if that was to pass, we certainly will not oppose that had that come through. And that compromise language would affect would change the statute to say that you cannot use other sources of money. The problem with that we had testified at House Finance in is that will not save the full $2 million that House Finance cut out. The present donation situation, as testified by Margaret Branson, looks at around $500,000 to $750,000 is the most that could be saved. So our problem with that in the House budget is that we could not save the full $2 million with that language change. So
this was their proposed compromise.
It was handed to Senator Eliason, who has Senate Bill 651, which does amend 4740. So we cannot say that would be ours. Presently, with the $2 million, we have to testify that repeal is our only way in order to manage this kind of budget.
Well, yeah, this paper's from the department, isn't it? Right here. I know it's not on official stationery. Well, somebody put it on. Just leaves the impression that both Department of Health and Social Services and the healthcare providers had gotten together and agreed on this language.
Well, I think that Representative Phillips, we did meet with them and indicated that if that was submitted, if that's what the legislature ended up with, we would not oppose the language. What I'm saying is that that language will not get you the $2 million. And I'm saying that if that language was placed in, then we're still going to need another $1 million in order to run this program. That's all I'm saying.
Which is going to be damn hard to find right now.
Okay, so that's what I'm saying.
Yeah. Representative Phillips, I think in a letter which we presented to Representative Fuller, we indicated in that letter that this language was presented to us and that we could either go to the repealer or that language. Our preference is the repealer. The entire bill is not an adequate bill. We have very adequate granting processes, probably as sophisticated as you're going to get for a period of time. And this is the way we go out with most of our funding to other groups. It would be a very fair, negotiated type of contracts where they would come in and bid for it. There would be some competition. There may be some competition. I would doubt it, because most of these people have the homes, they have the facilities. But it means it would be like prospective budgeting. They would come in ahead of time, they would be given a grant for 3 years' work, they would know what they're spending, we would know what we're going to be expected to spend. And I think you'll see in there where we have agreed with their language. If that we choose to go that route, our preference is a repealer.
Representative Hayes.
But if I understand you, Commissioner, if we rescind our action in removing the repealer, then the action of the Rules Committee would be satisfactory to the to your department.
That's correct. Just repeal the statute.
Representative Hayes.
I move and ask unanimous consent that the Rules Committee rescind its action in removing the repealer for AS 4740, line 5, page 10 of the Finance Committee substitute for Hospital 357.
Is there any objection? So moved.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming down at this late hour and the 11th hour. Representative Hayes.
You folks are working very hard, and I appreciate the time you're putting in.
That we move out of committee a Rules Committee substitute for Hospital 357.
And putting back in the repealer.
But yes, we would include the repealer.
Unanimous consent? So moved. Next bill is 834. I don't think we'll probably get through this, but I know you have to get ready. Would you prefer to?
Well, we can take about two.
Well, just start on it anyway.
Why don't we go up until 5 minutes? I can leave at 5 minutes till 9.
All right. Very good. This is Senate Bill 834, an act continuing the existence of the Guide License and Control Board, and providing for an effective date. The reason for this meeting is a proposed amendment to Senate Bill 834. When did the game guide board meet? Last week or the week before? Last week, in a meeting of the guide board, they adopted a regulation in the Marine Mammal Act to allow people from the villages to become registered guides. Just a short history of it. At the present time, we have about 4 registered guides that are native people with several assistant guides. They've worked up a pretty good program where these people will be tested both in written test and heavy weighted on oral tests for some of the people that aren't that communicative in English language. This section 2, they want to amend so the board shall adopt regulations for marine mammal guiding in accordance with this chapter in the Marine Protection Act Amendment of 1981, PL 97-228. There is some, I believe, opposition to this amendment, and I called to let these people testify. Representative Fanning, I believe, is the first to testify. Would you usually done if you're by yourself, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Ken Fanning.
The only problem, I think that what the way the chairman has described the events are pretty accurate. The a little additional background is that the regulations that he spoke to that the guide board adopted last week were regulations that began by the guide board and the representative from Nome getting together in Nome with all the fellows who do currently guide or have in the past guided four marine mammals, the Eskimo World Wars Commission and members from all the villages, and they came up with an agreement from the boat captains and everybody else as to what they wanted to, what they felt would be good types of guidelines that would be required for special marine mammal licenses along the coast. Coastal area's got a lot of unique things that are not applicable to the rest of the state, and I think that the industry throughout the rest of the state certainly doesn't feel that somebody guiding for walrus ought to be able to know the Boone and Crockett tabulations for caribou, since they're not going to hunt for caribou. So there is definitely a reason for adopting special guide license for mammal guide license. And a consensus was reached among those fellows involved in the industry, the natives involved in the industry, at that meeting, and that's culminated in the guide boards adopting these regulations whenever their last meeting was in Fairbanks. I would point out, however, that the regulations adopted by the guide board are in fact draft. I have a copy of them today. They are not in effect until the Department of Law authorizes them. And as Representative Fuller suggested, until there's statutory language authorizing the guide board to do that, they probably do not have that authority. And so I do not disagree with including language in this legislation which authorizes the guide board to create marine mammal guides. Specifically, the amendment, if it were to say, the board shall adopt regulations for marine mammal guiding in accordance with this chapter, period, I would have no objection whatsoever. I would submit to you that the regulations adopted 2 weeks ago that I have here by the guide board, the regulations as devised by the whaling captains and everybody else involved in this thing, do not meet the requirements of the Marine Mammal Protection Act of 1972 as mandated or as interpreted by many individuals. And I'll read to you from sections of the law and which should explain, why my objection to inclusion of the specific language that says the Marine Mammal Protection Act of 1972. The law itself states, the Secretary may not transfer management authority to the state of Alaska under subsection B1 for any species of marine mammal unless, and then it goes down to the pertinent part here, the regulation of such use, including but not limiting to licensing of marine mammal hunting guides and the assignment of guiding areas, will to the maximum extent practical provide economic opportunities for the residents of rural coastal villages of Alaska to engage in subsistence uses of the species. There's only one problem, is that that's the only area in the state that all the guides, including all the guides up there, agree that you do not put into exclusive areas. That's the one area that they've decided, and at their own request to the guide board, that it maintain be a single open area, because walrus move, obviously, and many of these other marine mammals move. And so while you work out of Savunga, or while you work out of a certain area, you do not have a single landmass that you identify, and that's the only place you can hunt. If you do, you may be required to hunt during a season when there are no animals there. Obviously, it's different when the migration comes through. Secondly, if you go back further, the report language that accompanies, that relates specifically to that provision that I just mentioned, contains an expansion that I think, and many others think, is inconsistent with the law itself. But it would require a lot of other things. The bottom line is the following sentence: if competent and knowledgeable local residents are available, they must be licensed. Period. No ifs, ands, or buts. If anybody's there who is a local resident who is competent and knowledgeable, whatever knowledgeable means, he must be licensed. I would submit that these regulations are absolutely contrary to that. The boat captains themselves don't want anybody there that's knowledgeable. They have have a unique hierarchy in the tradition of who gets to be a boat captain, how you get to be a boat captain, how you maintain the respect of the village, how you maintain the respect for traditional hunting activities. And I think that we should respect that. And I don't think that by placing this, they have before the simple extension. And I fully agree with including language which allows the board to adopt regulations for marine mammal guiding and even provide a special fee or something. I thought you were going to have an additional thing there that allows for a fee. I've got no problem with that. But to mandate that it has to be in accordance to the Marine Mammal Protection Act of 72, when there is continuing controversy about the difference in interpretation of that act, and it seems already that it flies in the face of that which the natives in the area who are affected have already come up with. You know, I think it's just asking for an additional burden that's not going to be a benefit to you. So I would strongly urge that the committee adopt the amendment. However, prior to adoption of the amendment, delete the words "and the Marine Mammal Protection Act of 1972, PL 925216 U.S. City Sections follow as amended."
Is your concern what you mentioned, exclusive guiding areas, and that we're not going to have them? But I submit to you that the guiding areas are exclusive, because there's only about four places really that you can hunt walrus. I mean, you might have a few operations like somebody hunting walrus out of Nome, but who wants to go 80 miles in a aluminum boat? This does not. Do you say that the last information you quoted that it would be, we would destroy everything we've done so far with meeting with the guide board and setting up the training programs and the tests and all that? You're fearful that you say the young bucks are all going to say, to hell with you, I got aluminum boat and I'm going to start guiding.
And the federal law requires that you allow me to do that. The area concept, Jack, while there's only four or five areas that that walrus hunting is active, of course the four guides that you're speaking of specifically, many of them guide in those same areas. And if they were exclusive areas, that would not be allowed. Only one guy could go there if it were an exclusive area. In other words, the whole idea of...
Well, we didn't want it to be exclusive areas.
We did not want it to be exclusive areas. You wanted to get more fellows into the industry and make an economic, viable economic opportunity for villagers. It could easily be interpreted that the federal law would preclude that, would mandate exclusive areas, and also that the federal law would mandate licensing anybody who's competent, whether or not they meet the requirements that the natives themselves have come up with, as in these regulations. I agree with these regulations, and I agree with the fact that we need to give the guide board authority to adopt those regulations. But I just think that the federal law at this point in time has got so many questions about what it mandates and what it doesn't mandate, that by adding that specific language is going to throw up a potential loophole that could well destroy what was intended specifically by the boat captains involved in those various negotiations.
Well, I'm not gonna move on this too rapidly today. There's not enough time. I gave you a short fuse on it. I want to look at it some more. And I think that we have to have another hearing. That will give you some time to make some additional preparation. I'd appreciate having those regulations. I don't know if we have them yet, or if they said they'd send them to me, but they didn't yet. But if you'd allow us to have a copy, I'd appreciate that. And
Keith Speckman might want to make a comment from the governor's office and the administration.
Well, I was going to ask Keith to come down when we have more time, because the speaker has to recess.
The speaker has to speak.
Yeah,
he's going to session 3 minutes.
I'm going to recess the Rules Committee until the call of the chair. Okay?